dedicated to all the hackers and the crackers.
To the hackers and the crackers.
I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll sue you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISO? Let me through my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. You see, G, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones. And NASDAQ leaves you flat on your back. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack.
This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial code, source codes, ISOs, RANs, SIPs, SIPs. This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to Binary Revolution Radio number 163. I am Stank Dog with you again this week. Our air date this episode is September 12th, 2006. And you're in for a special treat this episode, as I try to keep from spitting all over myself. We are actually coming to you with another BinRev first. We bring you lots of firsts on this show. So this week we're doing our first ever. I'm having a really bad time with the show today. We're doing our first ever, is what I'm trying to say, double header, our double feature episode, back-to-back episodes of Binary Revolution Radio, trying to get back on track here. Get a couple of very technical shows in this week and kind of get the flow going to the show again. And the reason this is a first on BinRev Radio, this particular episode has two reasons for being a first. It's the first time we've ever done a doubleheader, two episodes. But this is also the first time where my co-host has been live in the same room, where we're actually not on the phone. We're not thousands of miles apart. We are actually about a foot and a half apart. So, Quine, welcome to the show.
All right, thanks. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, I'm not sure about the sound quality. We did as best we could trying to do some sound checks and stuff up front, but I'm so naturally loud that it kind of made it a little bit hard getting a nice, decent sound check. So, we're going to see if this holds up, and hopefully there's not too much background noise in this episode, but it can't be worse than 159. I mean, let's move on, and since we have two episodes this week... We're gonna kind of split up all of our normal housekeeping stuff and split up our emails so that we have more time on each individual show for the main topic of that show. So, did you have any kind of housekeeping? Actually, we should probably mention, we usually mention it at the end, we'll mention housekeeping that our BR407 meeting is this Friday.
Yes, it is.
So, this airing on Tuesday, say Thursday, Friday, 3 days from... Kind of, 4 days?
Well, that is if everyone, you know, listens to it by then.
Yeah, nobody listens to the show. What are we talking about? So, other than that, anything else worth mentioning?
No.
Well, you're going to be... Actually, let's give a little backstory to the today's topic.
Okay.
Today's topic being open source security tools, which is kind of a vague topic, but... I wanted to do this episode because you put together a presentation for this for an upcoming conference.
Yeah,
or something. What is that about?
Open source security tool. Open source in general is just such a... I mean, that topic could be, you know, a series of shows in and of itself, let alone its own show, its own dedicated radio show. So this topic is just very... I mean, we're scratching the surface on this, and... Hopefully it'll uncover some things, maybe a few people that know, or if anyone's just getting into a subject area like this, and kind of plant seeds in people's minds of, you know, more tools they can go out and find.
And some of these tools that we're going to talk about today, many of our listeners have not only heard of, but are very, very familiar with these tools, but some of them they may not have, because there were some that I was not familiar with. So hopefully, even though a couple of them you may have heard of before, maybe you'll hear something or learn something new about them that you didn't know, but you'll also pick up some of the other tools that you may not be familiar with. So, let's do... We're going to split the email up this week as well. But let's do a couple this episode and a couple next episode. So let's give that a shot now. Alright, so actually, kind of, let's put this under the email housekeeping portion. I don't want to read the emails, but I wanted to give a quick thanks to Craig, who sent me an email about having the file size on the podcast wrong last week. When we copied the file over, we have a script that copies the file over from one server to another, and it was uploaded fine, it streamed fine, the original file that we sent out, everything was fine with that, but the script that copies the file choked for whatever reason, so it sent over out of a 15 or so megabyte file, it sent over a couple hundred K, so it just died halfway through, and I didn't realize it when I added it to the podcast, and we have a little kind of a, I won't say a little bit of a content management system that we use to feed the podcast feed, to feed the podcast feed, yeah, something like that. So that was my mistake, and I fixed it quickly, thanks to Craig for sending me an email about that, letting me know. Now, as far as the email, I think really there's just one very short email. We'll save the rest for the next episode coming up in an hour and a half. Stay tuned for that. So our first email, and only email for this episode, comes from Prince Vegeta, and it is very short and to the point, and it just says, quote, I just wanted to say that episode 149 was one of the best. So, straight to the point, Vegeta, thank you for that. I appreciate it. And episode 149... for those of you who may not remember offhand, was with our good friend, Tabiz, longtime friend of the show, longtime friend of mine in real life from the BR561 meetings, and also our newest forum moderator, Tabiz, so welcome him to the forums, to moderating of the forums. Of course, he's been around for a while, as many of you know. The topic on that episode was digital forensics, where we went down this long list of different tools with some interesting discussion and information about different forensics tools, whether it was hard drive encrypting, decrypting, data recovery, et cetera, that sort of thing. And if you like that show, then I think you'll also like tonight's show as well. So I thought that was kind of a good segue into the main topic tonight. So it is also good to know that people are still listening to the archives. I know we do get email occasionally of somebody replying to something from even early episodes or months old, several months old episodes. It's great that people are still listening to those. I do still believe. I occasionally will go back and listen to an old episode or look for something specific, and I am surprised and proud of how well they stand up. A lot of that stuff has not expired. It hasn't changed a whole lot, so the principles and the things that we're trying to explain and hopefully teach about, the concepts don't really change that much. So really, you can start listening to some of those old episodes, even starting with one and try to catch up sequentially, or listen to the newest one while you start to catch up and keep up to date. And there's still a lot of good information. So please feel free to take advantage of the archive. Don't worry about the bandwidth. I'll cover that. That comes out of my wallet. So I'm glad to do that if you're enjoying and learning from the show. So that being said, Quine, how about we kind of segue here into the main topic, which again is open source security tools. Now, first of all, why are we, we're talking about open source tools, not free tools.
Right.
Not freeware, not whatever, I mean, open source tools, which obviously means the source code being available.
Source is available, and generally you can modify it. Of course, with some licenses, there are constraints that suggest that you should redistribute that source, the modified source, with the same license or with acknowledgments that are defined within the license. So this is very, very specific. This is what the man told me I needed to talk about.
The thing is, we could honestly, we need to limit it, because there's so many security tools out there, we could spend episode after episode. We could spend an episode on each individual one if we really wanted to try to focus on details of each individual tool, which actually may be good shows to do at some point. Now, open source, of course, referring to open source code, the source code being available that you can view the source and see exactly what the program's doing and how it's doing it. Now, why are we, when you say open source tools, why are we focusing just on open source tools? We're not covering freeware, right?
Right. This is software for which the source code is available for you to view. Generally, we're referring to ones that you can modify and redistribute. Some of the licenses, of course, say that you need to redistribute it with the same license for everyone else to see that source code as well and modify it and do the things that you did to it.
Well, and licensing is an interesting term to bring up because there are lots of different types of licenses on open source software.
Yeah, there are a ton, and there are a few that are pretty adaptable, one of which being the artistic license. Usually you won't find the official definition of an artistic license. People are allowed to kind of adapt that to you know, how they want to come up with their own constraints or licensing terms, but it kind of falls under this artistic license umbrella. Ones that other people are most familiar with, of course, are like the GNU General Public License, the GPL, the LGPL BSD license, Mozilla Public License, and of course Apache. And there are a few others that could be used as an open source or an open source license, like Creative Commons.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm kind of thinking to myself, we really could go into a whole episode just about that. So we probably shouldn't spend too much time here, except obviously knowing that there are several different types of licenses, but all work well with open source software. So maybe we'll do another episode about licenses separately one day. I'm not going to put you on the spot now to do it. But
wipe the sweat from my brow.
But we do. It is worth mentioning, of course, that there are the licenses exist on these, because sometimes people that don't understand open source don't realize there is a license. It's just that the license allows you to redistribute the source code, look at it, modify it, etc., whatever the limitation. But there is an actual license. It doesn't mean there's no license. There's just a very liberal license on what you can do with that source code.
Right.
Now,
and within the context of the presentation, really what we mean by open source is the one that goes by the jargon file, which is, and I quote, open source is a term coined in March 1998 that followed the Mozilla release to describe software distributed in source under licenses guaranteeing anybody rights to freely use, modify, and redistribute the code. So just keep that in mind. That's really what we mean when we say open source.
So textbook definition, so to speak. Now, what are some other factors? Like, let's say you're looking at open source software. Now, again, from a hacker standpoint, a lot of this stuff, quite frankly, we don't care about to a certain extent. Like, we just want to download it, compile it, and it works. But a lot of listeners of the show do have to be concerned with things like licenses. What other concerns would somebody like that have? I mean, and maybe even hackers to a certain extent might find some of this. I mean, like, for example, is it important, like, who's writing the software? Like, whether it's some, 13-year-old kid who's writing his first application. I mean, is stuff like that even come into play?
Well, yeah. I mean, you want to take into consideration, is this piece of software you're looking at, is there a community behind it? Does it have a good reputation? I mean, if you're going to be running, a project on the side, that you're hosting something, your website or your content management system, as an example, what is the reputation of this software? Is it frequently known to have vulnerabilities reported in it? Is it stable? Is the team behind it a core team, as in the case of something like OpenBSD, or is it just a bunch of loose-knit contributors who are just contributing pieces of code, uploading things, submitting things into Subversion or committing things in CVS, left and right with no real sanity checks here, Is there someone who's reviewing this code, so to speak, or is it just kind of people throwing snippets here and there and putting it together, hacking it together?
Kernel hackers.
As an example.
As a good example, yeah, I think so.
So, another thing is maybe, is this a mature piece of software? Has it been around for a while? Or is it in alpha or pre-alpha, and has it been sitting there for a long time now, or did it just come out last week and Does it have kind of a exposure to the field, so to speak?
Now, and I kind of said this as a joke earlier that hackers might not care, but to a certain extent, we do care. Is it work? Is it going to do what we expect it to do? Or is it going to give us false information? So we care to that extent, obviously. And if it's something that, again, some 13-year-old kid could have written, and it could be brilliant. You know, user feedback and stuff like that comes into play. You can other people that have been testing it, beta testing, forums, things like that, where they're giving you some feedback.
Yeah, I mean, you want to look at is there a community behind this? Is there a mailing list or a forum or a wiki or something where people have information available and feedback, user feedback available? What do other users have to say about things like this, about this piece of software? Or is there some resource you can go to, someone that you know that's used this software and can vouch for its stability, for its reputation?
Well, and that actually brings up another good point. That, and this kind of goes back to maybe if you're using this in an office environment, or again, even as a hacker, for the most part, hackers provide their own support, I guess,
right,
you would say,
right.
But sometimes you'll find a problem or a bug, or let's again shift to the office scenario, if you're actually wanting to use this as a security professional, and we all know how much I love them,
hey.
But seriously, sometimes you need official support, and let me phrase it as a question. You can or cannot get support for any, some, or all of the tools that we're about to talk about?
Most of the ones that we're going to talk about are generally not... there are a few of them that do have support available. In the cases of ones that don't have official support from the developers or from the people who manage or control this piece of software... there are some organizations that do offer third-party support for open-source applications. So let's say you go to Red Hat and you buy, you get Red Hat Linux. They'll offer commercial support.
Well, Fedora.
Fedora. You can still get Red Hat Enterprise.
For free?
You could download the source.
Really?
You can get the binaries as well, but like to do updates, you can register one box,
right,
basically,
gotcha,
per email address. But you can get commercial support from them for certain pieces of software that they may sell. But there are organizations, there are companies that basically devote themselves to supporting open source software that might not otherwise have a support team behind it. Again, this kind of goes back to getting support from the user community, from the developers, from any other, or just learning about it yourself and kind of being self-sustaining.
Right, and that's the hacker side.
Right.
That's the hacker methodology, unfortunately, because part of it was from the hacker side, where it's just like my experience with support of any and all kinds that I've ever had is that the person on the other end of the line knows less than I do about the software, and that gets really frustrating. Or I can't understand what they're saying to me, no offense, but they can't speak the language, and they want to walk me through the level one stuff. Oh, turn on your computer. You must restart your computer. Okay, look, I've done that, and I've done taking a look at the code, and I've sniffed the packets, and it looks like they're being malformed. Can I talk to somebody a little bit higher up? Okay, buddy, hold on just a minute. Did you reboot your computer? Yes, I rebooted the computer. Shut up. So, yeah, I find that support for open source software is infinitely better than commercial software, because of commercial software vendors, that comes with as part of the price of the software. With the open source, it's more community feeling. Like, what jumps to mind for me for that is, well, besides Linux, which has got so much support all over the place, and I know some of the listeners are kind of tired of hearing about this piece of software, but Asterisk is like that as well. So
it's
that's got a lot of aftermarket support. And actually, the other thing that I have to say I like about the way they work there is that they do provide the software and make their money on the support. But so do a lot of other outside third-party companies provide support for it. A lot of free forums, mailing lists that are free provide some sort of support for it. Even our forums, a lot of Asterisk stuff gets worked out and debugged through the BinRev forum. I mean, so many different ways that you can get support. So, obviously, I guess the bottom line is the more, the better.
Well,
yeah.
It's just reliable. Well, you got to take into account that a lot of organizations, a lot of companies, it's all well and good that you can get free support for this piece of open source software via forums and user communities, but they kind of have to CYA, so to speak, and cover their own butts,
right,
and have official commercial support so that their customers, you know, they can kind of give this warm and fuzzy to their customers and say, oh, well, if we do have a problem with such and such a piece of open source software that we run, we can refer to company XYZ that supports it. So we don't have to
right.
be, you know, scrambling to look through docs to figure out why this is doing this.
And something else kind of funny in an interesting way, in an interesting and a funny sort of way, is there are some tools out there that are perpetually in a state of beta.
Yeah.
Because
right.
they never want to officially release anything, possibly that being one of the reasons, because then they have to support it, then they have to answer for this being final, fully tested code and things like that. And in their license, they can say, hey, this is very common, as is, we hold no responsibility or liability and stuff, those kind of clauses that you'll find in a lot of open source software, because they're not a company. They're not making big
right.
money, so they're not going to take that liability. But I actually, a lot of commercial software has been putting those clauses in there as well. So maybe that's because they're stealing a lot of open source code and putting it in. But that's a whole nother topic.
That's a show in and of itself.
Exactly. We won't go there. Although there's been some great stories. I know a friend of mine, well, Abaddon, better known probably these days as Mike Lynn, had one of the funniest stories of that I ever saw. Was over on Meme Streams with the... now help me out here if I can't remember the name, but it was Pear OS or something, the Apple, where it was a copy of Apple,
right?
And he decompiled and found actual evidence of source code that was ripped off, where the bytecode matched or something along those lines.
Well,
it was hilarious.
I think it was Pear OS.
That's what it was, yeah.
Complained that Cherry OS had taken software taken code from them.
That's what it was.
And it was like all the... it was identical. And they were saying that, you know, Cherry OS was like, we never took anything.
Yeah.
I think that, you know,
we are not held us for... Don't hold us liable if that's a little bit off, but I do think that's accurate.
That's the gist of the story.
Exactly.
Without wasting time going and looking it up on the proverbial interweb.
There is one other thing that I think is important to mention before we start going and listing and talking about some individual tools. And that is the other big, and I would almost say the biggest benefit. I really would say the biggest. Well, I guess realistically the biggest benefit is that they're generally free. Let's be honest. I mean, that's what a lot of people are using them. But the biggest benefit, in my personal opinion, is the fact that because you have the open source, that makes them infinitely flexible. If you need it tweaked or changed, you have the source code. You can recompile
right. And
make it do what you want. So flexibility, I would say, is a big thing. Now, do you think, that being said, the majority of people are just compiling it as is, or even downloading binaries, even though it's open source, they'll still download the binaries of it and not mess with it.
Do I think that's the case?
Yeah, I think it usually is the case, but there still is
a vast number of people who are, you know, fixing bugs in this software. Could there be more? Yeah. And I think a lot of people don't contribute back to these projects. They don't submit bug, you know, changes. They don't. That's why so many projects die. It's because the one or two people who started them and maintained them have lives too, and they can't devote all their time to this. So they need people to contribute changes back and contribute fixes, give feedback, take the helm when it's needed.
My world and welcome to it.
Yeah. Right.
All right, so we're going to actually... is there anything else that you want to talk about before we get into, like, listing through some tools and discussing some of the specific tools?
I think we can segue into kind of what do we mean by open source security tools.
Okay.
And then we can kind of go into the tools themselves.
All right.
So what do we... You know, we talk about what open source is in the context of this talk. Now we want to talk about what we mean by open source security tools, because even that in and of itself is kind of nebulous.
Right.
I mean, that can mean different things to different people.
Right. And
so
actually, there's kind of a misconception that people have on, and again, I'm not going into a rant about security professionals, but people don't realize that they think that if you become a security professional, you get paid to hack. or pen test or stuff.
Right.
A lot of that work is boring writing up of, not to insult it, but it's writing up a lot of password policies and rules for the company that you have to follow. You're only allowed to use this VPN client, or you're only allowed to use this type of antivirus, and you have to update, and you have to change your password. You have to do a lot of policy work, and that's a lot of what most people, anybody who thinks they're going in and going to have exciting pen testing and lots of tools and playing, a lot of it's writing and
well, again, security is just as in the same vein that you can do a lot of different things related to hacking, because hacking
right
means different things to different people. So does security. Or information security, computer security, network security, whatever you want to call it, has so many different aspects to it. And there's so many different paths you can take.
Exactly. So that's what I was alluding to.
Right.
Yeah. So, now, you broke these down into three different categories, or do you want to go there yet, or did you still want to...
No, I still want to just kind of clear the air, so everyone's on the same page, so to speak. What we mean by open source security tools in the context of the talk is software or applications that are covered under an open source license that are designed to either test or enhance one security posture. That could be an attack in one case, or testing and security testing, or defense. Also, we have some other things that may not actually be security tools. Just security tools, but may have an application to security. For example, Open LDAP, which we'll get into a little bit later. I'm sure some people are familiar with that. We'll go over that a little bit more later in the talk. So, we're going to cover, without further ado, we're going to actually dive into the tools themselves.
And you broke them down as
right.
far as, and I like that. I think this is a good flow to the presentation that you're going to give, as well as for the show, is breaking them down into, in kind of what you're just alluding to, tools of attacking, tools of defending, and then other, I guess, miscellaneous things that aren't quite as easily categorized. And actually, I found it interesting that some of these you classified in a group that I really didn't think that was where it would go at first glance, but you did it for a different reason that I didn't really think of at first. So I guess we'll just kind of go through the list, and as that comes up, we'll...
Right. Okay. Yeah, like I said, we're going to start with attack tools. And again, as we said before, this is just scratching the surface. I mean, this is not representative of all the tools that are out there.
Of course.
I mean, we have so much time to fill and talk, but we could go on and have a year's worth of shows just dedicated to this. I mean, we could branch this off into its own radio show.
Yeah, we're probably going to talk about, 10, 15, 20 tools in this whole thing. And
right.
Each one of those, that's not an exaggeration, each one of those could probably be an episode.
Exactly.
They really could, to go into the depth, especially because they're open source. We can talk about how they do it, why they do it. Talk about source. I think that might be dry radio to listen to, but
yeah. But this is just scratching the surface. But hopefully, with this information, people will kind of get motivated to learn more about them, or say, "Oh, I never knew about that tool, or I didn't know this tool did that."
And again, some of these tools that our listeners are going to be very familiar with; others maybe not. So I guess let's just kind of go through them.
Enough about that. Let's get running.
Attacking tools.
So we're going to talk first about EtherCAP. And for those of you who aren't familiar, EtherCAP is it's an active and passive protocol analyzer, or sniffer, as it's commonly referred to. It has a variety of features. Most notably, and what a lot of people who are familiar with EtherCAP know, is that it does ARP poisoning, address resolution protocol poisoning, which for those of you who aren't familiar, ARP is what maps IP addresses to MAC addresses or hardware addresses. And using that technique, we can effectively do man-in-the-middle attacks on switch networks and get in between hosts and capture traffic that would otherwise only go between them. It also supports data injection, so that we can actually inject data into the traffic stream that we might have control over on, say, a switch network or in a shared network where we really don't have to do man in the middle or are poison. We can just inject the data into the traffic stream. And as do a lot of other tools, EtherCap also has OS fingerprinting or operating system fingerprinting to let us know what operating system the target host might be running. This is passive, of course, as opposed to nmap, which is actually sending traffic to the host and is a little more detectable. This isn't completely stealthy, especially if you're doing ARP poisoning, then traffic is actually being sent out.
And don't a lot of intrusion detection systems, I think you were telling me this when we were doing this at the meeting, about a lot of intrusion detection systems, IDS or IPS, they look for an unusually large amount of ARP packets, and that triggers some of them, right?
There are some IDSs that have that capability, but bear in mind that most intrusion detection systems typically look at layer 3 and up, which would be the network layer. Example, IP. They would look at IP traffic and up. ARP poisoning occurs at layer 2, or the data link layer.
Now, also, this is actually one of the ones I referred to a few minutes ago where I wasn't sure, I was kind of surprised at where some of you classified some of these EtherCap as an attack tool, because I've always thought of it, I guess I never really thought too much about the ARP poisoning or the data injection, I've always thought about EtherCap as a completely passive tool, a sniffer, like you said, that's what they're commonly referred to as. I've always thought of it as simply a quiet, passive tool that's just sniffing the data, doesn't let anybody know it's there, doesn't send anything out, it just stays in the middle, quietly sniffing all the traffic and either redirecting it to you or saving it so that you can come look at it or get it later or whatever. So I never really considered that an attacking tool.
Well, it really could be. I mean, there are plugins for EtherCap that do different things. One of them, for example, would be to find other nodes that are doing ARP poisoning. Another one could be the Banshee plugin that was in there for a while, and I believe is still in there, that actually just kills connections over and over again. So that's, of course, a little more of a denial of service.
Yeah.
But a lot of these tools may feed into one another. I mean, if you're sitting there capturing traffic, that could be data that you could use later, such as, you know, usernames and passwords, or you could inject data in there and cause something else to occur, which would, you know, be a type of attack. So a lot of these tools may be chained together to formulate one big giant attack, so to speak. EtherCap is covered under the GPL, so...
Well, and every one of these, I don't know if we want to mention the license for all of them, if it's too much, but these are all under some open source. Your mileage may vary. Go check out the individual ones. And
a lot of these, of course, will tell you what license they're covered under.
Send me naked pictures of your boobies license. Is that...
I don't know. That's
it's an artistic license, huh?
Yeah, that's definitely an artistic. Well, what do you call it? What do you consider art? You know.
Well, let's not go all Mapplethorpe here or anything. That's a whole different show. I don't know what show that is, but it's not this one.
Right.
Now, staying on topic here, EtherCap, there is a GUI for this.
Well,
right?
there's a curses interface, which
the
is a console. Menu-driven interface, but there's also an actual GTK interface for it, so you can actually point and click.
Right, cursors is what I mean. That's your
right.
It's not a windowed GUI like an X Windows or
right. It's a character-driven menu interface, but there is also a GTK or GNOME, you know, GIMP toolkit.
Now, is there much difference between the two? Are they pretty?
No, they look pretty much the same.
Really,
just little, you know, cleaner for some people.
So, all right, well, EtherCap, again, it's kind of an interesting that you put it into attack tools, but since I think of all sniffers, the whole category, as a passive tool, so it gives me a new way to look at it and to think about it. Now, what other kind of attacking tools do you have in here?
The next one that we're going to touch on is Yersinia. Yersinia is really... I think we called it at the BR407 meeting the network fuck you up the ass tool. that was how it was.
Well, it's easier to pronounce than Yersinia. Yersinia. Just in case we're not enunciating.
Right.
It's a very unusual name.
So Yersinia is a multi-protocol attack.
It's an accurate name too, by the way. It really, that's an accurate name for the tool.
Network fuck you up the ass.
Exactly.
Yeah, and the reason that being is, whereas a lot of other tools, network attack tools or packet crafting tools, do just that. They craft packets. Yersinia really does more, does like layer two frames. It does layer two attacks. Some of those include spanning tree protocol, CDP or Cisco Discovery Protocol, DHCP, HSRP, which is Hot Standby Router Protocol. It also does VLAN Trunking Protocol and 802.1Q, which is also used for VLANs. So what this allows us to do is, to give you an example, Spanning Tree Protocol is used to eliminate loops within massive switch networks. And within SDP, or Spanning Tree Protocol, it also allows switches to know where other switches are located so that traffic can get from one switch to the other. And in the case of switches being interlinked, it will cause these crazy traffic loops. So within STP, we have what's called the root bridge or the root roll, and that is kind of like the core. That's the switch that knows kind of the infrastructure, that knows the
right. There's one
the topology.
There's one that's a
and everything kind of goes
an official right.
And there's all these other spanning tree is a mathematical. A mathematical tree, and it uses the spanning tree protocol uses these different path costs to determine where the traffic needs to go and what the shortest path is and everything.
Right.
Well, Yersinia, as an example with regard to SDP, allows us to do things like become the root roll, so that all traffic kind of goes to us
instead of whatever the other root roll
right.
Roll
and also allows us to send out. Raw topology updates so that we can tell SDP that the network topology has changed and it'll have to go recalculate all these path costs and everything, which can be bad because it can kind of bring down a network.
Gee, you think?
In some cases, as SDP has to relearn the network. It also, Yersinia also allows us to manipulate VLANs in a Cisco environment via a VLAN trunking protocol. We can add VLANs, we can delete VLANs, and what that would allow us to do is just that, create our own virtual LAN. Yersinia can also be used to actually hop VLANs, which has commonly been something that people have had this misconception that VLANs can be used for security. They were designed for security. They were really designed more for management, more for creating virtual networks within a physical switch, so we can have virtual LANs that are physically on the same network device. So Yersinia can be used to actually hop VLANs or to have all VLANs come to one port. When they would otherwise not be sent to that port.
Yeah, but the SDP is my favorite part of it.
Right.
And actually, I had not heard of this tool. This is one of the ones that I said I was not familiar with. So this was a new tool to me, and I found it very cool. Now, this also uses curses, is that right?
Yeah, there's a curses interface. There's also you can also do it via the command line and just have it execute a particular attack. There's also... It can run in what's kind of a server mode where you can connect to it as though you were connecting to like an iOS device and kind of run commands that way. They really touched on this a lot in hacking Cisco Networks Exposed. The guys over at Arhant Security went really in depth with this utility, and they did a bang up job talking about it.
And that what was that again? That was
Hacking Cisco Networks Exposed, or Hacking Exposed Cisco Networks. It's
okay.
A book.
No, that's what I wanted to make sure that this was heard. Yeah. That's not from Syngress, is it?
No, that's actually from...
They do the Black Hat series.
Right.
Who is it that does the Hacking Exposed?
Oh,
my goodness. Okay, well, I guess we'll let the listeners figure that one.
Is it McGraw-Hill?
No, it's not McGraw-Hill, is it? I don't think so. I don't remember. You know what? You guys can look that up, you lazy bastard. All right, anyway, next tool. Since I can't remember it, I shift the blame to the listener. See, it's easy as that. But it's going to bug me for the rest of the show now. It's sitting in the back of my head. If I remember it before the show is over, I will let you know.
Right.
It would be great if we could somehow access information through some sort of a browser or something online where I could look stuff up when I need to find the answer. If they ever invent a technology like that, some sort of like interweb connected network of
the worldwide
something like
Webernet.
That would be really handy right about now.
So yeah, you're sending these STP BPDUs, as they're called, Bridge Protocol Data Units, can cause massive problems in networks that use spanning tree, or they can be used to make you the root role, as I said before, and have a lot of traffic sent to you. Now, of course, you need a machine that can handle that. Otherwise, you're going to be noticed when the network slows to a complete crawl.
Well, or maybe not, depending on how your network might be. That might be normal for your network.
Again, we could do an entire show on Yersinia, and you know, maybe one day, maybe we will. Also, if you go to Yersinia.net, there was a presentation done at Black Hat 2005 that might be really, really useful if you want more information on Yersinia. It's a really good presentation.
Yeah, if you want more detail on it, that's definitely...
About the attacks and how they work.
Right, because we are glossing over these, talking about them from a, you know, give you a general idea of what a lot of these do and some of the features and stuff on them. And but certainly, again, gosh, this is like the third time I've said it, any one of these could be an episode in and of themselves. But for this particular one, check out that Black Hat presentation. Did you go to that Black Hat that year?
I did
05?
Not. No.
Okay. All right. So this next tool, what is this Nmap or something? Do we know? Is that?
Well,
I've never heard of this tool before. What exactly is this Nmap? No, I'm just joking. Actually, We're not gonna mention Nmap because I think I think our listeners know that. I was just joking around. But what about? And I was going to say this is a joke. What about Metasploit? Will we talk about that?
Metasploit framework.
Or, I mean, a lot of our listeners probably know Metasploit too. Should we go through into that one, or
I think we should just
explain what it is.
Well, okay. So Metasploit framework is for those of you who aren't familiar, is an exploit development framework. It's also an exploit testing and execution framework. One of the most notable things about Metasploit. Or the Metasploit framework, really need to be more specific than it is the framework, because Metasploit is the project.
Right.
Metasploit framework is what most people refer to as Metasploit.
Right.
So Metasploit framework separates the exploits from the payload. Everything is a module. So you've got an exploit module for, say, MS-04-0011 as an example. That's just the first one that comes to mind. So you have an exploit that attacks that. Well, then once you've exploited that vulnerability, you can then have a certain action occur, a payload. So let's say you exploit that, or you exploit a vulnerability in Samba, for which there's a corresponding Metasploit framework module, exploit module, and then you want to add a user, or you want to return a shell or
whatever the payload,
execute a command. You can kind of have different, you know, payload than going to Packet Storm and downloading something that already has the exploit code, the shell code, and, you know, everything already there. You can decide what you want to do.
Right. So, like, if the exploit that you developed gets you total root access to the box, you could actually write three or four different payloads of what you wanted to do. Do you want it to pop up a shell where you have root access? Do you want it to upload a file that's owned by root? I mean, you could write whatever payload, or is that...
Well, you can have
multiple exploits for each payload. You can have multiple exploits that have the same payload. They'd be written. They're independent from each other, but they do the same thing. But you can also have one exploit with multiple payloads. That's what I'm trying to say. Can't you have multiple payloads for each?
Essentially. So, you know, like I said, you would choose the exploit.
I'm trying to think of one example off the top of my head, and I can't come up with a good one, but the important thing being that it separates the two stages, the two phases, exploits being one separate part and payload being a different separate part. They're not independent exactly. There is a relationship between the two of them, but they are two separate things.
All right, so, like, as an example, let's say you encounter an IIS box, which, you know, what are the odds of that, right?
Right.
And it's, for whatever reason, it's, you know, let's say, here's an example. So you have a Windows 2000 IIS box, so it'd be IIS 5, and for whatever reason, lazy admin hasn't updated his box, and he's running front page extensions, and I'm like reading what one of the
a specific example, more specific.
So this particular one would be MS-03051, and that was a buffer overrun in front page extensions. So you would say you would choose that particular exploit, target that particular server, and then you decide what payload you want after that. So let's say you could have it return a command shell to you. You could have it add a user, execute a specific command, or in the case of Windows, actually inject the VNC DLL and have it return a VNC desktop to you.
So, or
you could have it. You could write your own payload that did something completely
right.
Different.
Even though the exploit, using an exploit that's already there, write your own payload for it.
Right.
And it's kind of hard to put that in. That's exactly what I was trying to explain earlier. It's hard to put that into words.
Or write your own exploit and use a payload that's already there.
They can be independent, but they don't have to be independent. And it's, I don't know, I guess it's one of those things that it is easier to see.
Right.
In real life, that's a more visual thing, so unfortunately we can't do too much justice to it on the radio. But,
So, like the current stable version of, and just for those of you who are familiar with the current stable version of Metasploit Framework, it's written primarily in Perl.
That's version 2.6?
2.6 is the current version. But the new beta version, which is 3.0, has been ported to Ruby.
Yuck! Ruby?
Don't say yuck Ruby.
I'll say yuck Rails. I can say that.
I'm not a web guy, so. And there are multiple interfaces for Metasploit Framework. There's a curses interface. It's not a curses interface. It's a GNU term read line interface, but
it's a similar.
It's a shell kind of interface.
Yeah,
I don't know why I said curses interface. I'm thinking Yersinia and Ettercap again.
Yeah.
I don't have my notebook with me.
But there's also a web interface for this as well.
There is a
right?
web interface. It comes with a little web server, and you can kind of point and click at your target, select. You can filter by OS, filter by application, filter by architecture. Pick what exploit you want. Pick the payload. Fill in a few fields and click, and there you go. And it's attacking your host.
So you have to have done a little footprinting ahead of time to know about your target system and what they might be running, what vulnerabilities they might have, that sort of thing.
Generally, yeah, that would be advisable.
And that would come back to Nmap, which we glossed over, and maybe we should have.
Right, yeah, we
but
we
whatever.
Would, yeah.
I think our listeners know what.
Fairly familiar
yeah,
with
Nmap. They know Nmap, and they know Metasploit pretty well.
There
too,
are some
so.
Cool features in newer versions of Nmap, and there are some cool add-ons that are coming out, one being like the Nmap scripting engine. But that's something we can go over. In another show, or
yeah.
even on
well,
on,
it's
on
still
the
being
forums.
Developed, right? That's not out officially. Is there a beta, or is that
no? Nmap scripting engine is out. I'm not sure what the status is right now.
It's interaction with Metasploit.
No, this is
no. Okay, separate. Okay.
I don't see why you wouldn't be able to script it in there. And
yeah.
have these things interact, as in the case of something like BiddyBlah by.
All right. Well, and let's see. We talked about the web interface for it, so. Point and click and hack the entire web. That's always good. I should give this to Verbal because I think he sucks at the internets, right?
He sucks at the online.
At the online. I'm sorry.
That's what he sucks at.
At the online. Yes, our listener last week said that he sucks at the online. So maybe he could use this. Now, You know, here's another tool I see here on your list, which I'd be tempted to skip over because some people might know this, but I would rather at least mention it briefly, and that is Hydra, or actually it's what, THC?
THC, the Hacker's Choice. That's a European hacking group that's been around for many, 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 many years, and they've written a variety of tools. They've had such a profound influence, and they've done so much for the community. They've written war dialers. They've written. They've written a lot of tools.
Yeah, the Hydra though is something. The THC Hydra. Should I say THC every time I refer to it? Proper. Okay.
We could just call it Hydra.
Okay.
Hydra is a multi-protocol brute force cracker, and it's parallelized, so it can run multiple jobs at once. It performs 36 different attacks against 36 different services, including Telnet, FTP, SSH, Oracle, SNMP. The one thing about this is it's very noisy. So
well,
I mean,
all brute force tools are.
Bear in mind, this is brute force. This isn't your typical offline password cracker. This is actually attempting username and password combinations actively against a service. There are command line. There's a command line version, and also a GUI version as well.
And actually, speaking of that, maybe that's a transition to another tool that I had heard the name of but hadn't really seen too much until you showed me more about it, and that is WebScarab.
WebScarab is by OWASP, which is the Open Web Application Security Project, OWASP.org. WebScarab is a web application security testing framework that's written in Java. So anybody who has an aversion to Java should probably just either get over it or avoid this tool.
But I like this tool. So as much as I like to get over it, I actually did like this tool a lot. So even though I hate Java,
right? It's got a variety of features. Including an HTTP proxy, which doesn't seem like much, but that allows you to do manual request interception. So you kind of you connect back to yourself before you go back out, or connect to a box running this and go back out. And manual request interception will allow you to actually manipulate HTTP headers, add HTTP headers, remove HTTP headers. It also has a web spider, so you can spider a site and crawl it. It also has SOAP interaction for anybody who's doing like a lot of web services based stuff. One other thing that's really,
I wonder how good that actually works though, because that seems like it'd be very difficult to really step. Well, I guess maybe not. I guess you can follow the logic along just as much as anything else. I want to see it in action doing something SOAP related, if there's such a phrase.
Yeah, and web services is a huge deal right now, and it's
right.
Going to be big for a while.
Yeah.
So this
web
might
2.0?
Be something. If you're doing a lot of web services development or web application security testing, this would be a helpful tool. And one other thing to mention is it has a this is just a few of the features. It has a fuzzer built in, so you can do automated substitution of values, which might help expose like cross-site scripting attacks or SQL injection attacks. And it also has another scripting interface via Bean Shell, so you can do like some built-in sort of Java scripting, not JavaScript, but Java-based scripting within the WebScarab application.
Yeah, and the word fuzzer is actually something I wanted to go into on the show, and maybe we will again on a separate show. That's another. I'm getting a lot of ideas for some topics for upcoming shows, that's for sure. Fuzzing, or fuzzers, or fuzzing was a term I heard a lot at DEF CON this year. There were some presentations, and some of them were about fuzzing directly, and even the ones that weren't used the term fuzzing and used it in some of their research to develop whatever their presentation was about, fuzzing was something they used in the process. That was a word I heard frequently
right,
this year.
Right, and fuzzing is doing some generalized automated attacks,
not attack so much as it's really testing.
It's really automated, kind of general automated testing to cause software faults or to cause application faults, which can later then be investigated or dove into a little bit more to determine if there's an exploitable condition in a piece of software.
Right, and it's very much less. Well, not, I won't say less, but it's very something that's extremely useful, regardless or not in relation necessarily to hacking. If it is for hacking for obvious reasons, but really fuzzing is a technique that really is just in programming and debugging and testing, unit testing. You run fuzzers against your own code to see if there's any holes to it, if there's any flaws, if you're going to send something to it that's either going to not only exploit it, but break it all together, cause bad data to get inserted or updated somewhere. So just from a testing, software testing standpoint, it's valuable in that aspect, and it's kind of creeped into the hacking community for the same reason.
And a lot of...
from an outsider using those... Because if you didn't do it when you developed your software, somebody on the outside, a hacker, may be doing it to get into it.
Right. So it's a way of doing some kind of general, broad tests. Some other fuzzers that people might be familiar with are Spike or Peach Fuzz. Those are some fuzzers that are available. WebScarab, of course, is the fuzzer built into that engine is geared towards web applications specifically. A lot of people might be familiar with protocol fuzzers, which are helpful for seeing how certain protocols, unknown application level protocols, act under certain conditions, under some general conditions that might otherwise cause adverse effects.
All right, well, I tell you what, let's, I guess, shift gears here a little bit, if we can. We've still got a little bit of time left in the show this week, so let's spend some time and kind of shift from offense to defense, if you will, from attacking tools to some defending tools or some defense tools. And again, you've got some tools that you mentioned as defense tools that I hadn't really thought of in that way before. And really the first one that I think you were going to talk about, which was Snort, which a lot of our listeners are probably very familiar with as well.
Snort is often referred to as a lightweight intrusion detection system. It has capabilities to do just general packet capture and analysis, but it's used often as a network intrusion detection system. So you build these rules that have an attack signature or protocol anomaly, like certain header values that might be might be consistent with an attack, and it goes into the Snort Snort core engine, and then certain actions are taken, such as logging the packet, blocking it if you have Snort set up as an IPS, which it has that capability as well, with certain add-ons.
Yeah, and actually, I'm feeling kind of stupid now because I got my notes out of order there. It's actually the next tool that I was thinking attack, not from this one. So I made a kind of got my slides mixed up, but we're going to keep going with Snort anyway.
Right. So with Snort, we have a bunch of different preprocessors, which is another thing that's important about it, that normalize certain traffic before it gets passed off to the main engine. And there are a variety of output plugins as well. It can log to a database, can log to a flat text file, it can log to raw PCAP or packet capture files, or it can log to syslog, as an example, can fire off an SNMP trap. Snort is another topic in and of itself, and it's been covered ad infinitum.
You mentioned the output plugins, and I think that's actually worthy of discussing for a moment, is, these tools traditionally were developed by a lot of different, most of the stuff has been developed by hackers, and maybe adopted and used by a lot of the security community, and security professionals had a lot of input and assistance with a lot of these as well, but as they're becoming more and more widespread use in corporations who are actually taking security seriously, it's not... Traditionally, a lot of attention hasn't been paid to the output or displaying or organizing of output so clearly, and I think that something else is starting to come around in a lot of these tools. Not especially defense was the first ones that really made it in a more readable fashion, but even attacking tools now, if you want to do pen testing of your own boxes or internal testing and stuff, that it's starting to generate output in cleaner, nicer, prettier, whatever you want to define format, so that it's easier to read for upper management, we'll say.
Right, and in the case of something like Snort, when you have it set to, say, log, you know, log to a database, and, you know, like a MySQL or Postgres backend or Oracle backend, where these the IDS alerts are actually being sent to, they could then be displayed by something like Base, which is a front, a web-based, a PHP-based web front-end for those alerts, and it can generate graphs and all sorts of pretty reports for, you know, the
upper
higher-ups.
Management.
And
yes.
Then kind of a little more of a easier-to-manage format for intrusion analysts. Squeal would be another good engine, S-T-U-I-L.
I'm saying that kind of as a joke, upper management.
Right.
No, it really is helpful to anybody. It saves a lot of time, how you present information. If I don't have to spend 5 minutes digging, searching, grepping to find the lines or the information that I want, you know, I don't mean to belittle it. Generating output that's user-friendly and easy to maintain and find and search through is definitely a very important factor to add in there. It is, unfortunately, probably the least important behind general functionality of
right,
the tool
and
itself.
Again, Snort is something that we can talk about for four shows.
Right,
you know?
Right, absolutely.
Just the flexibility of this app.
Yeah, so, amazing. And actually, now I'll kind of explain what I was saying earlier. What I meant to be saying was I thought that our next tool coming up was, and what it is now, is Kismet. And that's the one I was saying that I kind of think of that more as an offensive tool than a defensive tool, because I'm thinking of it from the war driver standpoint.
Right. And typically it is associated with that. A lot of people think Kismet. They think, you know, detecting and doing war driving, detecting wireless networks, collecting traffic on these networks.
Right.
But it can also be used for, like, site surveys to see where your access points might be, where their limits are. Or doing distributed wireless intrusion detection. One of the things that Kismet has is it has some basic wireless IDS or WIDS capability. That's another acronym that's popular is WIDS, wireless IDS. It has some basic signatures to see if other people are sending out are out probing for wireless networks. One of the things is like it'll say, such and such a node is probing networks but never participating, so that might be someone running NetStumbler. It also has the capability to, and actually we briefly talked about
the difference between NetStumbler and Kismet on the first episode of Hack TV about how noisy NetStumbler
right.
is.
NetStumbler is active, where
right.
Kismet is
passive.
Passive. Kismet will actually watch other people beaconing and watch for traffic on a certain channel and pick that up rather than actively sending out probes. It also has the capability to watch wireless networks and capture the traffic and write that to, say, like a socket from which something like Snort could read. So you could have a Kismet sensor watching for, you know, wireless networks that aren't necessarily your own, or watch an access point through, you know, which Kismet is not necessarily actively associated, but watching the traffic on there and then have it sent back to a Snort, an instance of Snort that's reading from a socket or something, actually watching the traffic.
Yeah, and that's
and
another
alert on, you know, any
that brings up another
traffic.
Interesting point, and that is we're addressing these as separate independent tools.
Mm-hmm.
But when combined together, when you get some interaction between a lot of these, they become even more powerful when they cooperate and work together. They're being developed independently, but some of these groups are actually actively working with each other, either whether it's providing XML output formats that then this in turn uses, or sending it out to a common database that they both decide to use for ungodly reason, MySQL, or something like that, that they can share, and, you know, they're sharing information back and forth. But if they're not directly connected, you can write your own Perl scripts, custom scripts, things like that. But just the general nature of them that I see anyway, is that they're starting to come together where they have that common ground and cooperating with each other instead of being standalone independent tools.
Yeah, and there are initiatives going on right now to try and come up with common language, so to speak, so that tools, intrusion detection tools and vulnerability scanners can all kind of talk the same language. I just said language, to talk the same language, so that they can all interact, so that a vulnerability scanner that said you're vulnerable to X, XYZ, when you see that attack corresponding to XYZ on your network intrusion detection system, it kind of gets flagged as a little bit higher because, you know, you're known to be vulnerable to that.
Right.
So...
So, yeah, this is another one of those tools our listeners are very intimately familiar with. Kismet is very common, and it's cousin Kismac. I don't want to put you on the spot with this question. I don't know how familiar you are with Kismac, but is Kismac very far behind Kismet as far as functionality, I wonder?
No, it's...
And maybe that's
I'm
something
not intimately
a listener,
familiar with, yeah. with Kismac, and if anyone wants to, chime in on that,
radio@benrev.com, and let me know. This is just me throwing out a question to the audience, actually. So.
But I don't know how it is on in terms of doing some of the defensive things, doing like distributed wireless IDS. I don't know.
I guess I could probably go to both sites and do a feature comparison list or whatever.
You could,
but
yeah.
Or I could pose it out to the listeners who already have done that work for me. Send it in, let us know. All right, how about a couple other defense tools here? Some of these, again, these are some that I have not heard of, and our next one here.
So PacketFence is an open source network access control system. If anyone's familiar with things like Cisco NAC, Network Admission Control, this is an open source implementation, so to speak. This runs on Linux. Because it does a lot of things with netfilter or IP tables.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do is this has a registration capability via an HTTPS web portal. So you would register your system with that once you first plugged in and got handed out an IP address. It would watch for any traffic you're emitting using Snort to see if you were scanning other hosts, anything that might be consistent with worm activity or other malware. And it would also scan your host to see if you have any known vulnerabilities or missing or anything that might be associated that could be addressed via a patch or simple configuration change. It will isolate any host that may be infected or otherwise insecure via IP tables. And it would also redirect them to an appropriate URL or web page or website that would have information on how to download patches or remove any malware that might be on their system. And once that's all done, they would reinitiate these scans and traffic analyses
until eventually you met
the criteria and it either adds a rule or drops a rule that thus grants you access to the rest of the network.
Yeah, and the first application that jumps to mind of this for me is at... Well, I guess companies would be, people that bring in their personal laptops or something and plug into the network. You want to be careful. But the first one that jumps to my mind, and maybe this is just because of my background, is higher education. Universities are famous for this. You got kids in the dorms. You got kids with their laptops. You got people coming in and making them, make sure they have, because, I want to say, college students don't really take the best care and aren't the most secure people with their laptops.
And actually, PacketFence was originally developed at a higher education facility to address some of the things with students, things like students in dorms who have, their one little laptop they got when they went off to college, and they're not updating patches, they're not updating their antivirus signatures.
They're still downloading Windows 95.
Who knows what from Kazaa.
But this one is an open source one. So
right. This is free.
Now, actually, I am going to ask and question the license on this one, because if you're using this at a large university, this is not just a person using it privately, which generally open source is kind of the way they go, is normally a one person or a small business or whatever using it. But this, if you're running this at a large university or at your company, what license is this actual one? What type of license is this one?
This is a GPL. It's a GNU General Public License. So this one is the license with which most people who use things like Linux are a little more accustomed.
Normal GPL. Okay.
So there are no you're fine to use it. If you can use other GPL software, generally you should have a problem.
Yeah. All right. Now that one was another one that I had not heard of, but the next one actually, and I'll you know what, I'm going to slide one in of my own here, because one thing that I think is important to everybody is antivirus.
Mm-hmm.
And antivirus, there's lots of free ones or free versions or even online scanners out there, but there is Clam antivirus. And
right.
There's also its bastard cousin, ClamWin,
right.
Which is just the Windows version of Clam antivirus. But, again, we'll kind of gloss over because I think this is one that's very common. But for people out there that are ever looking for an open source antivirus engine, I think Clam is certainly worth mentioning in this. And it seems to me it would be obviously defensive.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
and
I don't want
to tie into a lot of other tools as well. So you can have it do, content filter, malware filtering, and virus filtering via through SendMail.
Yeah, I was going to say it plugs in and scans the mail coming through, so that's really handy to have in there. But it also, again, really ClamWin, and I'm not like endorsing it or anything, but because I use AVG Free, I have several antivirus and spyware scanners running at any given time on all my machines, so I definitely liked both of those, AVG Free, which is not an open source thing, I don't believe, but Clam AV is. So.
Well, one thing that people
actually, ClamWin probably is not, but it's powered by Clam, so.
Well, one thing people have to keep in mind is, just because they run Linux or one of the BSDs and are a little, let's just say, less susceptible to viruses, it's still, for best practices and for things like defense in depth, it's still advisable to run antivirus and have automated, have scheduled jobs that scan or scan incoming mail, or even in the cases of products that do support on-access scanning in Linux and FreeBSD, to use that when possible. Even if you're not vulnerable to or susceptible to common viruses, it's still just good practice and getting habit, mm-hmm. so that when something does come out, you're not, you've already beaten it to the punch.
Okay. All right. Well, did you have any other defensive tools that you wanted to bring up?
There's another one.
Or we can move on to the quote-unquote other.
One other thing is the OSSEC project, OSSEC, has a host-based intrusion detection system called OSSEC HIDS. It's a host-based IDS as opposed to network-based IDSs that look at traffic on the network. This looks at aspects of the host itself, which can include things like log analysis, integrity checking, like file integrity, or to make sure the host is there aren't any like bad modules loaded. It also does rootkit detection. It has multiple ways of alerting email, other log entries, things like that. And one thing that's neat about OSSEC HIDS is it also has active response. So you can have it execute a command or script out certain things that it can do based on certain log entries that it sees.
That name gets me.
OSSEC.
It's just
OSSEC
awkward.
HIDS.
OSSEC HIDS. It just sounds awkward coming. It's not. I feel like I have Down syndrome. OSSEC HIDS. I don't know what the hell. It just sounds weird.
OSSEC HIDS has. You can write these correlation rules so that, based on different kinds of events, it can kind of assemble what maybe a certain attack was. So it sees a bunch of failed logins and then a successful login within a certain time window. That can be indicative that maybe somebody was brute forcing an account and eventually got in. So then it can send maybe a high priority alert to you. It also, one cool thing about OSSEC HIDS is it also supports Windows in addition to various Unix platforms. But on the Nix platforms, it has both the agent and the server because it has centralized reporting. On Windows side, it's just the agent only. So,
all right,
that's all right, another one that we can talk about.
Every single one of these. And actually, you know what? I guess we do have a few other tools, miscellaneous tools, or whatever we're going to call this. But before we do, I'll go ahead and say to the audience, and normally I'd wait till we're all done to say this, but if there are any of these specifically that you would like someone to go into more detail, if you'd like us to do an episode, I hope I don't get emails from everybody saying every one of those go into more detail. But if there are some that you're more curious about than others, like I don't think anybody would really want us to do a full episode on like Kismet, for example, because I think so many people are already familiar with it. And some of the, you know, Nmap. Well, but see, Nmap's got so many. I don't know. So I'm saying to the listeners, you know, what of these tools has really piqued your interest, if any of these, and that you'd like to hear more detail? Like, again, we're just going through a list and giving you an overview of some of these. So if there's any that you would like to hear in more detail, please email us and let us know, and we'll see if we can't put that on the upcoming schedule to, you know, go into some more detail on a few specific ones.
And see, that's one thing I'm trying to do is not spend too much time on one of these,
right?
And so that we can kind of just, okay, so this is what it does, and let's move on to the next one. And
that's kind of what I said earlier. I'm getting a lot of great ideas for upcoming show topics, which is always, you know, the people that have done the show in the past, that's the one common thing they've said to me is, it's difficult to come up with topics, or how do you come up with all these different topics? Well, there's really a lot of them out there. It's just how much depth you want to go into it. So doing a show like this, where we can open the doors and say, here's a lot of different tools, here's generally what they do, and people will either go into it by themselves and do their own research and find some things, or they'll ask us our opinions, or can we go into some more detail on it, and we can certainly do that, but we don't want to go through the detail on every single one of these because, yeah, I mean, I haven't even counting how many we've done so far, but we've been 10, 15 episodes by the time we're done with this.
Yeah, so I don't want to sound like a banana head, like I don't know what I'm talking about with these tools, but I don't want to spend too much time on one of them.
A banana head?
That's from Empire Records, actually.
Oh, okay. You got me on that reference. That was you. Yeah. Caught me on that one.
I like that word, banana head.
Banana head. All right.
So
not like banana phone. Ring,
no,
ring, ring, ring.
No.
Okay. All right. Well, how about some miscellaneous tools? We do have a few minutes to talk about a couple other miscellaneous tools. So what do you think? Some of these, I think we won't. As a matter of fact, I think we'll skip over.
Yeah, we're
like
going to skip
OpenSSH. People know OpenSSH
right.
Pretty well.
But, I mean, just a lot of people need to know also that OpenSSH is not just an SSH client. It can be used to wrap otherwise insecure protocols, or protocols that might otherwise be in clear text.
Right, and you know what?
And build SSH tunnels.
Funny, you know, that's going to be a good segue into episode 2 tonight, the second of our back-to-back episodes where we go and talk about tunneling. So that's going to be a good segue into that. So that's perfect timing. Now, how about, you mentioned earlier, I think you mentioned Open LDAP.
I just gave it as an example. Open LDAP is an open source implementation of LDAP, Lightweight Directory Access Protocol. So it's a directory server, an LDAP library, and it has client components. One thing that how this applies to security is we can create like a centralized authentication service. A lot of people might be familiar with Microsoft Active Directory, which is also LDAP-esque, and you can perform certain LDAP operations on Active Directory. So the reason I just mentioned Open LDAP again is to do like centralized authentication, so that we don't have usernames and password user stores and username and password stores on multiple systems. We can have one consistent centralized authentication server to which all these things, you know, to which all users are authenticated, regardless of what system they're logging. Now, a lot of people can argue, too, that, well, now you've got one central place that people need to break into to get your username and password. That's a gray area. It's debatable. Yes, that might be true, but
right.
In terms of management and administration, that cuts back so that you don't have accounts, stale accounts on multiple systems that you didn't know were there.
Right. And that, well, it's, you know, it's that balance of ease of use and convenience, versus security. So yes, you are putting them all in one. You're putting all your eggs in one basket, so to speak. And I think I've said this about. I think my example one time was talking about Microsoft Passport being a single sign-on, but that is also a single point of failure. I mean, not necessarily in regards to OpenLDAP, but having all your authentication coming from one area. However, you also to play the other coin of that is now that you've got it all in one spot, you can concentrate all your security efforts on that one spot as well. So,
yeah, it's an argument. It can be argued.
Yeah, back and forth. Yeah, it's basically just an opinion, and however you feel either way on it. And actually, I see both sides of the argument, so I don't really have I don't pick a side per se in that argument. I see both sides at the point.
Yeah, as do I.
And it's a balance. So
for people looking for an alternative.
Yeah, don't send us hate mail. We're not endorsing either side.
Right. For people who are looking for an open source alternative to something like Active Directory or Novell eDirectory or something similar, this would be a good example. And it, or if you just want an LDAP-based address book, I don't know.
Well, hey, whatever.
So another thing that we can touch on real quick is OpenVPN. VPN, of course, virtual private network. A lot of people are familiar with IPsec-based VPNs or PPTP if you're ever so unlucky. But SSL VPN, secure socket layer VPNs, are a big thing too. OpenVPN is a user space SSL VPN implementation that is, of course, open source. It'll run on most Nix platforms, BSD, Linux, Solaris, so forth and so on, but also on Windows as well. It takes advantage of OpenSSL, which is the open source secure socket layer library, which also does a variety of other cryptographic functions.
And it is open source?
It is open source. OpenVPN authenticates users through PAM, pluggable authentication modules, which can in turn be extended to a number of other authentication mechanisms, such as LDAP or SMB, through Active Directory or whatever. Pick your poison,
right,
MySQL,
whatever.
PostgreSQL, any number of backends. It has load balancing and failover capabilities, and there are GUIs for it. So for anyone who's accustomed to Cisco's pretty VPN
or
client
Microsoft
or AT&T or anything like that.
Whatever.
There is a front end for this. This could be helpful if you want secure access into your home network.
Yeah, and this is also going to be this is a great segue into the second episode tonight too, where we get into a lot of details about VPN when in relation to tunneling and obvious reasons.
So,
and
a whole other episode in and of itself, VPNs.
And it will be. Stick around.
Excellent.
All right.
So, one of the last tools that I've really kind of got on my laundry list here is FreeRadius. Radius is remote authentication dial-in user service, and that's used a lot for authenticating. Traditionally, was for authenticating dial-in users for modem pools and things like that,
okay.
Or for remote access.
Okay. Yeah, dial-in.
Remote access dial-in user service. It's a free open source implementation of Radius. It's one of the top five Radius servers worldwide, based on number of users that are authenticated to it every day, and based on deployment. It's deployment base. Supports a variety of backends, including LDAP, MySQL, PostgreSQL, and Oracle. Yay, Oracle, right?
Yay!
One thing that's cool about FreeRadius is if you're familiar with 802.1x authentication, a lot of people know it as one of the implementations, which would be like Cisco Leap, which would be layer 2 authentication, 802.1x. You can authenticate users before they're really on, given an IP address or before port-based authentication is what it's sometimes called.
Right.
FreeRadius supports that. Of course, your client needs to support that, but FreeRadius can be used to do that. It doesn't tie into something like necessarily like into PacketFence, because PacketFence is layer 3 and up.
Uh-huh.
But FreeRadius, if you're looking for an alternative to Cisco's Cisco's authentication server, this would be an example.
This supports multiple extensible authentication protocol types, EAP, including Cisco Leap. It supports proxying, failover, load balancing. So if you're worried about, you know, my free radius server went down, well, this has the capability to have, you know, failover radius servers. So,
okay.
Again, this is a whole other topic in unto itself, but, you know, this is just planting the seed for people who want to kind of learn more about these tools. And like you said, if anyone wants to us to cover these more in depth, they can. There's also another, there's an entire presentation, how-to, rather, on doing 802.1x port-based authentication via free radius. That's at the Linux Documentation Project, tldp.org. You can find that there, and that'll give you all you need to know how to do 802.1x authentication with free radius. So, that's really all I've got for the tools. I just, you know, think there's a lot of great open source security tools out there, and people need to contribute back to open source projects.
Amen.
So that's a huge thing. A lot of these, that's why a lot of these projects die or don't really go anywhere, is because people
or stagnate. Yeah.
They take the code, they use it, but they don't really give any feedback. They don't contribute fixes. They don't contribute enhancements or features.
And that's something. Someone in IRC used the perfect word one time when we were having a conversation about this. And they just admitted up front that they are a consumer. They're not giving back. They're not contributing. They are a consumer. They are using the product. And there's nothing necessarily wrong with it, but just if you do find something useful, or if you can think of ways to enhance or help a project, or even if it's just feedback, a bug report, anything as small as that, or spreading the word, getting you know, getting other people to come and embrace the project, and maybe if you can't contribute directly back, maybe they can, so spreading the word indirectly helps out, so that's always a good thing.
Or if by chance you have any, you know, free money lying around,
yeah.
A lot of these developers,
I don't think they turn down...
Right, no, they, you know, if you can contribute, in the case of things like OpenBSD, contributing hardware or testing things out yourself, that always helps too. I know in the case of a lot of operating systems, people, they can really use hardware donations.
All right. Well, I think that's gonna about do it for this episode of the show. If there's anything, I think that's pretty much all we really had to. Again, I mean, it's one of those shows where it's kind of, and we've said this many times during the show that we could go into more detail about any of these, but I think this was a good overview of several tools. The way we limited was to only focus on open source tools this time. We have in past episodes of the show gone into other tools in more detail, and in the future we will go into some in more detail. But if any of these specific ones that you'd like to hear, or if you've got some information that you want to add to what we've already talked about, by all means, email us at radio@benrev.com. Our site of the week is actually completely unrelated to the show, but in an article that I read in one of my magazines this week, I think this was from, I don't think this was in Popular Science. I don't remember. There was some magazine that I read this week. What is this right here? It was Popular Mechanics, not Popular Science. And the site is spudtech.com. That's S-P-U-D-T-E-C-H, spudtech.com. Which is everything you wanted to know, some directions, how-tos, advice, pictures, projects on making your own potato gun, which we do not have any liability whatsoever with anything that you may do, especially after I read that story. I think it was somebody, the guy won a Darwin Award. Did you ever remember that? This is probably going way off topic for the show, but there was a great Darwin Award probably 4 or 5 years ago about a kid who thought it would be funny to put a frog in the potato gun and shoot it. And it misfired, it didn't shoot the frog out, so being the brilliant person that he is, he looked down the barrel of the thing, and it accidentally shot off and threw shrapnel of frog bone through his skull, and he killed him.
That's sort of poetic justice,
isn't it?
In a way, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it was Just brilliant. The brilliant Darwin. Maybe you should make the Darwin's Awards the site of the week. And actually, since we have another episode coming up in a few minutes, you're going to get two sites of the week this week. So lucky, lucky you. And we're also going to split up the shouts this week. So any shouts that you have, I'll go ahead and stall a moment so you can think, and I will give shout outs to Savant, who I've been talking to a lot lately. Shouts to lady lately. And and I think you'll back me up on this, to the everybody at BR407.
Yeah.
So anything else you wanted to add to that?
I can give a few shout-outs now that I think about it.
Okay, go for it.
If these people are, you know, some of them, if they're listening, I don't know.
Of course, they're going to listen because you're on
right,
the show.
Right,
of course.
26 Hex and the old NOP crew. If
you're out there,
if you're out there,
contact me at radio.binrev.com and maybe I'll forward some information
maybe.
On maybe.
Or you know, pretend
or not.
To be me and respond to them.
There you go. Let's see. Closing music tonight is The New Pornographers. It is a song called Use It. So I think that's going to be it. Unless, did you have some more shouts before we close out?
That's all the shouts I have. Again, like you said, if anyone has any questions, they can email you, email the show
at
radio@binrev.com.
And I'm committing you to a future show.
I will gladly be on a future show.
If somebody comes
so that I can
go into more detail.
So that people actually know that I know what I'm talking about and can go into more in depth on some
I
of these
take
tools.
I'll take responsibility because I purposely reined you back and said, let's do overview stuff, which I know is difficult because you don't know where to draw the line and stop and going into too much detail or not enough detail. So I'll take the credit that I caused you. I reined you in, so future episodes, we'll pick a few of these and go into a lot more detail on it, so I think that'll something you're more comfortable with, since you know these much more intimately than I do, obviously. And that is going to do it for us this week. So, Quine, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And for the rest of you, we will see you in a few minutes, actually. Slightly different hack time.
Slightly different hack channel.
No,
same hack channel.
Same hack channel, I think. Something, I'm confused. Here's the music.